Headlines: supporters of Iraqi Shia cleric Muqtada Sadr storm Baghdad's heavily fortified Green Zone and occupy parliaments in a deepening political crisis. Thousands of train drivers across almost a quarter of Britain's rail network walk off the job, the latest strike in an increasingly bitter labor dispute in the country's railways. And the World Health Organization says that it expects monkeypox-related deaths to increase as it calls for international efforts to contain the disease that has spread to 78 countries so far. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iraqi protesters stormed parliament in the capital's high-security green zone for the second time in a week, amid political deadlock over the formation of a new government. The demonstrators, mostly supporters of cleric Muqtada Sadr, occupied the legislative body in the zone, which is home to various government and diplomatic buildings. They have announced a sit-in until further notice. Dozens of people have been injured amid clashes with security forces. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has called on security officers to guarantee the safety of state institutions. Sadr's supporters also breached Iraq's parliament building on Wednesday. The demonstrators are opposed to the nomination of former minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani to replace Kadhimi. Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas believes the ongoing political crisis in Iraq stems from the U.S. invasion of the country back in 2003.
Iraq has been in this kind of quagmire politically for as long as we can remember, certainly since the invasion of the Americans, and it's partly a constructed quagmire because the Americans didn't really create a plan where there was going to be genuine democracy. They didn't create governments or back governments which could really implement the kind of economic and political changes that were required. They didn't really enact any kind of efforts to eradicate corruption. Rather, they accelerated all this. So I put most of the blame of the current Iraqi predicament at the doors of the invading and occupying Anglo-American forces in that region. Well, the Anglo-Zionist American forces, I should say. As far as Muqtada Sadr goes, look, there are obviously these competing powers. The Americans have their own stooges, they have their own puppets and front men. The Kurds are involved in that, and many other tribal aspects in Iraq. So they back their own particular individuals. So the Iraqi people themselves go for anybody ultimately who is going to say we're going to support Iraq and we're going to save Iraq from the talons of foreign powers, in particular the Americans.
The death toll from the recent floods in Iran has risen to 56. 18 more people remain unaccounted for. 21 out of 31 Iranian provinces have been affected by flooding over the past week. The capital, Tehran, is one of the hardest hit areas. So far, more than 3,700 people have been homed or housed in emergency shelters across the country. Another 2,500 have been taken to safety. Relief operations are still underway. Flood warnings are still in place in many regions where people are advised to stay off riverbanks and valleys. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has also issued a message offering his condolences to the victims of the incident. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei called on government officials to take necessary measures to repair the damage. Iran's intelligence ministry says it has arrested a Swedish national on espionage charges. The individual was visiting Iran. A statement by the ministry says the Swedish national had been on watch during several trips to Iran due to suspicious behavior and contacts with European and non-European people who were under surveillance in Iran. The statement also said the suspect had visited cities without tourism processes. The statement did not say the name of the detained person or when the arrest was made. It said the suspect had a history of visiting Israel before traveling to Iran. Thousands of mourners attend the funeral of a Palestinian teenager who was killed by Israeli live fire in the occupied West Bank. 16-year-old Amjad Abu Aliyah was shot dead on Friday during an anti-settlement demonstration near Ramallah. Palestinian resistance movements have slammed the killing. Hamas sounded the alarm over an increase in the number of crimes committed by the Israeli regime in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Since late March, Israeli forces have killed over 50 Palestinians, mostly in the West Bank. Nearly 700,000 Israeli lives or Israelis live in settlements in East Al-Quds and the West Bank. All of those settlements are illegal under international law. Moving on to the war in Ukraine, Kiev says Russia has launched fresh strikes on a number of towns and cities across Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities say that two residential districts were targeted with rockets in the southern city of Mykolaiv. The mayor says one person was killed and six others injured in the overnight attack. To the northeast, a school in Ukraine's second largest city of Kharkiv was reportedly hit by S-300 missiles early on Saturday. Local authorities say the attack caused material damage, but no casualties. The governor of the eastern region of Donetsk says the city of Slovyansk came under Russian shelling also. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian presidency said that its forces had carried out strikes on Russian military warehouses and positions in the southern region of Kherson. The region, which borders Moscow annexed Crimea, fell to Russian forces only days after Russia launched its, quote, operation in Ukraine on February 24. Official data shows that U.S. economy shrank for two quarters in a row. That signals the unofficial start of a recession there, an issue denied by President Joe Biden and White House officials. They cite positive facts, including a low unemployment rate, but that alone is not enough to push economic growth. The Federal Reserve has already raised interest rates four times this year to control inflation, which is at a 40-year high.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession.
President Biden has said the U.S. has avoided a recession, citing steady spending and measures to rein in inflation. But that sounds like a broken record. Inflation is not tamed. Prices at the pump are lower only because the U.S. had to release more oil out of its emergency reserves. And it's quite hypocritical in a sense to say that spending is steady, as the U.S. public debt stands at over $30 trillion.
The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job, because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
Happening now, thousands of train drivers across Britain's railway network are walking off their jobs, protesting against low wages amid soaring inflation in the United Kingdom. Roughly 5,000 drivers took part in the 24-hour strike. Nearly all services on Britain's 34 train operators were canceled. Cancellations also took place in regional networks. The drivers are demanding higher pay. They say that current salaries do not meet the country's rising cost of living. The strike is the second major industrial action this week, after 40,000 other railway workers held a massive strike on Wednesday. Britons are dealing with skyrocketing living costs. Inflation has gone past the 9% mark, which is the highest rate in four decades. Sectors other than railway have also been hit. That includes postal services, health, schools, and airports, among others. A survey released by British advocacy group CAGE has revealed shocking feedback regarding British schools pushing Western propaganda on Ukraine while gagging any students' activism in support of Palestine. The findings appear to show that the UK government's involvement with both initiatives to peddle Ukraine sympathy and to outlaw Palestine solidarity. Rob Carter reports from London.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organisations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism programme. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged. And the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by CAGE against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalize any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
Spain has reported a second monkeypox death only one day after Brazil announced that what was believed to be the first fatality that was linked to the outbreak outside of Africa. The Spanish Health Ministry reported the first death on Saturday. It said that there are 120 others currently hospitalized. On Friday, Brazilian media reported the death of a 41-year-old man due to the outbreak in the state of Minas Gerais. The man reportedly had serious immune system problems and was being treated for other conditions. The World Health Organization has warned of further monkeypox-related deaths. The World Health Organization has warned that this needs to interrupt transmissions across the continent.
It's a very different sort of virus from COVID-19. For one thing, it's transmitted by very, very close contact. As we know, COVID-19 is transmitted much more through the air, and so and is much more likely to happen when you've got crowding and people in closed environments with poor ventilation. So the form of transmission is quite different. But we are seeing cases, as I said, in over 78 countries to date. We're seeing a large number of cases. So that is exactly why the Director General declared a public health emergency of international concern, to get the world cooperating now to stop it turning into a pandemic. See what you're doing right now.
Last week, the head of the WHO called the monkeypox outbreak a global health emergency, saying the outbreak represents a public health emergency of an international scale with the highest level of alert. Monkeypox has spread for decades in parts of Central and Western Africa. It primarily spreads through close physical contact and generally causes a mild disease. However, it can be fatal and can cause serious symptoms. More than 16,000 monkeypox cases from 75 countries have been reported to the WHO this year. Currently, only COVID-19 and polio are considered as global health emergencies. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
If all Greenland's ice melts, it would raise the seas by more than 24 feet, says Juan Kohlreiter in an article published under the heading, Greenland loses 6 billion tons of ice in 3 days, harbinger of unprecedented coastal flooding. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Both CNN and The Independent reported this week on a massive ice melt in Greenland, with on the order of 6 billion tons of ice lost in 3 days. The melting was because of a heat wave at the top of the world caused by burning coal, gasoline, and methane gas, and is spewing billions of tons of the dangerous heat-trapping gas carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. These sorts of events are directly responsible for sea level rise and coastal flooding around the world and in the United States, which has a lot of coast if you think about it. Often it is the poorest and most disadvantaged who will suffer most severely from disruptions like storm surges, coastal erosion, saltwater invasion of lagoons, and urban flooding. A heat wave in Greenland only makes it about 60 degrees Fahrenheit, when most of Americans would still feel the need for a sweater. But ordinarily, according to a climate and weather site, in July, the average maximum daytime temperatures are cold and range from 6 degrees Celsius in Cap Tobin to 10 degrees Celsius in Angamagsalik. Nighttime temperatures generally drop to 2 degrees Celsius in this region and 0 degrees Celsius in Cap Tobin. It is one of the warmest months of the year. So yeah, 60 Fahrenheit or 15 Celsius is a stretch. Loss of 6 billion tons of ice is worrisome, especially since all this is cumulative. Over time, all the surface ice will melt if we go on burning fossil fuels. But we've seen considerably worse, say Marsh and Fritz researchers. In 2019, they explained a hot spring and summer melted away the ice sheet's surface, sending 532 billion tons of ice into the oceans, raising them permanently by 1.5 millimeters. If all Greenland's ice melts, it would raise the seas by more than 24 feet. We can still halt an apocalyptic scenario like that, which would wipe out coastal cities around the world if we stop spewing out carbon by 2050. The existing CO2 in the atmosphere will all go into the oceans. That will make them acidic and wipe out a lot of marine life, but temperatures would immediately stop rising and would gradually go back to a 19th century normal. Average sea level has already risen about 9 inches since 1880, which has put coastal regions and cities under pressure. It doesn't sound like much, but it is a lot. It gets magnified if there is a storm surge and worsens flooding. Moreover, the oceans are not flat. They are higher in some places than others, and some parts rise faster than others. The ocean at Miami Beach is a full foot higher now than even in 1990, and floods and rain-free sunny days are 4 times more frequent than just 3 decades ago. The World Economic Forum found that African-American urban communities are most at risk from sea level rise, with the risk of flooding in their neighborhoods increasing by 20% by 2050. Flooding currently costs the U.S. $32 billion a year, but that number is expected to increase substantially if the seas rise at a rapid clip. We are seeing increasing coastal flooding alerts in places like Maine. Sarah Long at WMTW quotes meteorologist Donnie Dormont, "It makes sense we have more advisories just due to the fact that we are getting more coastal flood impacts. Sea level rise is not showing a super rapid increase, but it is constant. Every single year, we get a couple of millimeters, and you add that up over a decade, and you're just getting more coastal flooding than you used to. Note that a 10 millimeter increase per decade is nearly half an inch. But as we saw in Miami Beach, at other places, the increases are more dramatic." In Ghana, the Atlantic Ocean has already surged 6 feet into the country's interior, threatening to wipe out a whole series of coastal settlements. The erosion is accelerating, and the new conditions can interfere with fishing. People's livelihoods are in danger.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life. a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. You know, what we find in the lessons of Karbala and the responsibilities of the Imam of our time is that there is a link that exists between the third and the 12th Imam. This link, of course, exists between every Imam. They are the Hujjatullah, they are the proofs of God, they are the signs of God, they have the same knowledge. However, when we look at our traditions, we find that there is a special link and a bond that is associated between them. We recite in Dua Nudba the dua that we just heard, Aina Talibu Bidamil Maktuli Bi Karbala, that where is the one who will avenge the blood that was spilled in Karbala? And when we look at other traditions, we find that again there are many links that are associated with this. And so what we see is that there is a responsibility for us as those who are awaiting and wanting to fulfill our responsibilities to the Imam of our time, that one of the ways in which we understand what our responsibilities are is by looking at the tragedy of Karbala to try to understand what was the mission of Aba Abdullah. If we understand the mission of Aba Abdullah, we then understand that our responsibility is to fulfill that mission, because the mission of the 12th Imam is connected to the mission of the 3rd Imam. You guys follow? Yeah? This is essential. This is a really important point to understand, that there is this link. This is a statement that I am sure you will hear over and over again over these next 12 nights, but it's an important statement, for it's the mission statement of Aba Abdullah. In his letter that he wrote to Muhammad bin Hanafiya, his brother, he says, وَأَنِّي لَمْ أَخْرُجْ أَشِرًا وَلَا بَطِرًا وَلَا مُفْسِدًا وَلَا ظَالِمًا. He says, I am not rising joyfully or arrogantly, right? I'm not causing mischief. Nor am I rising to cause fasad, corruption, or oppression. Wa innama kharajtu li talabil islah fi ummati jaddi rasulillah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. I am rising. Innama kharajtu. I am leaving. I am rising to bring about a reformation, a change in the ummah of my grandfather Rasulullah. Uridu an amura bil ma'roof wa anha anil munkar. Wallah, we need to memorize this statement, right? Because as the azadar of Aba Abdullah, as the ones who commemorate the morning rituals of Aba Abdullah, we must understand the purpose of the mission of Aba Abdullah, right? It was to bring about an awakening, a change, right? The Ummah in 50 years after the Prophet had transgressed to the extent where the Imam had to rise and sacrifice with the ultimate of sacrifices, that which will forever be remembered, so that we realize there was a purpose behind what he did. He wanted to bring about a reformation. And as we said yesterday, right, that what this reformation means is to bring the Ummah out of ignorance, right? And when we look at our own lives, any time that we are following a path that goes against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants, any time my actions are contrary to what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants, I am in a state of dalal. I am in a state of misguidance, and I am in a state of ignorance. And what is required of me at that time is reformation. And so the ultimate goal for you and I, right, is to make sure that every single day we are reforming our lives. Every single night when we go to bed, we analyze our lives. We say, what went right today? What went wrong today? And I'm sure if we're honest with ourselves, there will be a list of things that didn't go as well as they should have gone. But that is where we have to sit and reflect and try to see how we can improve upon that which we did not do as well as we should have done. Reformation is how we continue progression. Reformation is how we continue the message of Aba Abdullah, because that was his mission, isn't it? Right? The mission was that, hence the responsibility for those who follow him is to continue to reform. But you know, reformation is not that easy, Yeah, if Reformation was easy, we would all be reformed by now, right? But Reformation is not easy, and there are numerous factors as to why Reformation is not easy. For one, it requires us to be honest with ourselves, right? To analyze our lives and look deep in our lives to say, you know what, these things need improving. That's not easy to do. Admission of guilt, admission of fault, is something we would rather just not think about, right? We are very good at blaming other people. This is his fault, her fault, you know, my wife's fault, this is fault. But I never look in my own life to say that, hey, maybe this was my fault maybe, right? And so we have to realize that we have to look inwards for reformation. And again, that's something that requires courage, yeah, to be able to say this needs improving. Reformation is also difficult because of the negative qualities that we have gained over time, right? Many of the qualities that we have gained over time served some form of benefit to us, right? Sometimes I'm sarcastic, but that sarcasm has helped me, for example, gain friends. Maybe that popularity that I wanted has gained me fame, for example, but it has brought about certain negative qualities. Breaking negative qualities is not easy, especially those qualities that have been established over a period of time, right? We give this analogy all the time that, you know, it's easier. This is why we're told never to sin, right? Why? Because once we sin, the taste of sin has remained in our hearts forever, right? And it's not easy to break, right? Even for those who have transgressed at one time in their lives, and now they have reformed their lives so that they don't transgress anymore, the remembrance always exists, does it not? Yeah, it always exists, right? The pleasures that I endured or enjoyed in the past always remain, and so we try to fight that battle at all times. If I could advise, you know, any youngsters who are here, man, don't sin. Yeah, it's not worth the headache that you will get later in life. It's not worth sinning, right? And so when we sin, we gain qualities which are negative. And those negative qualities are hard to break. Hence, reformation is not easy. But also another reason why reformation is not easy, you know, we're very good at changing something about ourselves if we notice immediate benefit, right? If we don't notice immediate benefit for something, the chances of me putting in the work to change that particular thing are very less, right? The problem is that we don't see Akhirah. We don't see the hellfire. And so we think that there's a prolonged gap here. So why should I change my life immediately? We live in a world of instant gratification, right? Things are done instantly. And when things take longer than instant for it to happen, we don't put in the exact work that is required for that particular thing. You know, if we look at this concept of instant gratification, yani instant results, if that is the lens with which we look at Karbala, then we will misunderstand Karbala. Why? Because if Aba Abdullah alayhi salam sacrificed his life, sacrificed his family's life, allowed, and the women were taken as prisoners, all of this, why? To end Yazid, well, Yazid lived after him. Yeah? In fact, there were many more Yazids after him. Yeah? Till today, we have Yazids. Right? And so if we look at it from that lens of instant result, then we would say Aba Abdullah was unsuccessful, na'udhu billah. But that is not the lens that Aba Abdullah was looking at it from. This is the problem. We're looking at it from the wrong lens. Aba Abdullah alayhi salam never had the intention or the desire to make immediate change. What did he say? Innama kharajtu li talabil islah, to seek reformation. He wanted to plant the seeds in Karbala. When our 12th Imam comes back, he will harvest the seeds that were planted in Karbala. But the responsibility of the Shia is what? To cultivate and nurture the seeds that were planted by Aba Abdullah in Karbala. Yeah? Do you understand? This is why reformation is so important. Aba Abdullah planted the seeds of reformation. 12th Imam will harvest the seeds of reformation. It's our job to continue reforming, my brothers and sisters. And this is the ultimate lesson I want you to understand. there is a link between the third and the 12th Imam. The link is who? Us. We are that link. The more we delay our reformation, the longer we are delaying the 12th Imam. The more we delay our reformation, we are foregoing the work that was done by Aba Abdullah. As the Azadar, as the people who remember the rituals and the mourning of Aba Abdullah, it is important that we focus on becoming better human beings every single day of our lives. And when we do so, we will uplift and keep alive the message of Karbala, and we will inshallah be hastening the return of our Imam. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. We now present you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled, Sino-forming of Global South Passes Point of No Return. China's exports to the largest economies of the Global South have nearly doubled from pre-COVID levels to a seasonally adjusted $70 billion in June 2022, from $38 billion in June 2019. Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. As Western nations question the benefits of globalization, China has become the world's leading globalizer. What I call China's plan to Sinoform the world in a 2020 book has advanced so far that it is beyond the capacity of the United States and its allies to impede. 500 million people in neighboring countries now depend on Chinese technology for their communications, data processing, and logistics, providing China with a nearly limitless resource of young workers for its industries and an ever-expanding export market. For China, economic outreach to the Global South is key to breaking through American efforts to contain China's drive for economic predominance. The influential Observer columnist Chen Feng on 28th of July wrote, "China has to solve the problem of generating its own independent growth momentum after breaking through the critical point of the Matthew effect. The economic maxim that rich countries get richer and poor countries get poorer." Chen Feng said, "America's comprehensive and unlimited anti-China campaign can slow down China's development at the cost of a greater deceleration of the United States." But China is not only putting in place a dual cycle that is promoting domestic consumption as well as exports, adding China also divides the external export cycle into two sub-cycles, Europe and the United States on the one hand, and the Belt and Road, Asia, Africa and Latin America on the other. What we observe in the trade data suggests that China's investments are paying off in most of the developing world. Western policymakers have been looking in the wrong direction. China's trade with the Global South plus South Korea and Taiwan is now as large as its combined exports to the United States and Europe. This is by far the most important event in the world economy since the rise of China itself. The populations of the developing world are dwindling at a faster rate in high-income Asia than elsewhere. The scarcest resource in the world is young workers who have enough education to enter the world economy. When Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese revolutionary leader, began his reforms in 1979, China's per capita gross domestic product was less than $200. And just 3% of adults had tertiary education. China's message to the countries of the Global South is, you can grow like we did. If you let us build your infrastructure, install your digital economy, construct your factories, hire your workers and sell you our products. In Vietnam, Indonesia, Mexico, Turkey, Brazil and a dozen other developing countries, political leaders have taken China's offer. The Carnegie Endowment wrote in an 11th of July report on China's success in Indonesia. Many claim that China exports its developmental model and imposes it on other countries. But Chinese players extend their influence by working through local actors and local institutions while adapting and assimilating local and traditional forms, norms and practices. In the case of Indonesia, for example, the Carnegie Report says, on average, Indonesians distrust China and many Chinese firms. Yet, top telecom infrastructure provider Huawei, and a lesser extent, China's second largest telecommunications equipment maker ZTE, have successfully positioned themselves as trusted cybersecurity providers to the Indonesian government and the Indonesian nation. This has been no easy feat, given long-held Indonesian animosity towards China. Many Chinese companies have faced protests over concerns they were taking local jobs. Huawei and ZTE have suffered no such fate, nor has there been a broad coalition of Indonesian voices against using Chinese technology in critical telecommunications infrastructure. In short, Indonesians care a lot more about Chinese cement plants than they do about Huawei involvement in fifth-generation networks. Carnegie reports Huawei is training 10,000 Indonesian officials in cybersecurity. China, in effect, is delivering a turnkey digital economy to Indonesia, with everything included from broadband base stations to training. On 25th of July, Indonesian President Joko Widodo visited Beijing, the first head of state to visit the country since last February's Winter Olympics. The Chinese website Observer commented, "On 22nd of July, high-level officials from China and Indonesia held a video conference and agreed on advance plans for the joint construction of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Global Maritime Fulcrum, and make all-out effort to ensure that the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed rail is completed and open to traffic as scheduled, and continuously deepen cooperation in the regional comprehensive economic corridor." The 145-kilometre rail link between Jakarta and Bandung is a prestige project, but it symbolises China's rising profile in Southeast Asia's largest country. China's burgeoning role in the Indonesian economy does not fit the profile of what American critics call debt-trap diplomacy. On the contrary, higher raw materials prices allow Indonesia to pay cash for Chinese imports. The country has run a current account surplus for the past 2 years. Chinese exports to Mexico now comprise 16% of the country's total and have grown as fast as China's exports to Southeast Asia. Telecommunications is a big contributor. Mexico in 2020 had 77 broadband accounts per 100 people versus just 23 in 2012. In between, Huawei built a mobile broadband network and the cost of service dropped by about three quarters. As a banker for a Hong Kong boutique, I brought Huawei officials to Mexico and Mexico's ambassador to Huawei headquarters in Shenzhen, China. Huawei explained to the Mexicans that they had a big economy but woefully inadequate broadband. The Huawei officials said, "They let us build you a broadband network and the ecosystem of e-commerce, e-finance and digital technologies that go with it, and you can become rich like China." In fact, Huawei had a published plan for the digital transformation of every country in the world. Many of them are in the advanced stage of implementation. China's investments in Mexico have risen rapidly in the past 2 years. $5.8 billion of China's total $20 billion commitment to the country was disbursed in the past 2 years, in part because Chinese companies are moving facilities out of the United States to its southern neighbor, Mexico. China's investment in Brazil, now the world's largest producer of soybeans, are considerably larger. Luis Augusto de Castro Neves and Tulio Cariello, in a 2022 book, report, "As of 2020, Brazil has received more than half of all Chinese investment in Latin America, around $66 billion, with three-fourths of that investment dedicated to the energy sector, and the rest going to agriculture, infrastructure, and other industries. Turkey's imports from China have tripled since 2018. China also is the country's largest export market. The first train to Istanbul from the Chinese city of Xi'an arrived in 2019 on a line built under the Belt and Road Initiative. China's largest transport company, COSCO Shipping, brought a $1 billion controlling stake in Turkey's third largest container port. China financed Istanbul's new airport with a $6.2 billion loan. Turkey's swap line with China allows it to pay for imports in yuan rather than in US dollars. As the Turkish lira crashed last year and Turkey's dollar reserves fell, the local currency swap line became a critical source of trade financing for Turkey. China's trade with the Global South could shift to national currency in short order. By 2019, China had established $500 billion in local currency swap lines with other countries. According to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, swap lines among Asian central banks are estimated at $470 billion. Financial technology is now available to conduct retail transactions directly between Asian countries. According to the Monetary Authority of Singapore and the Bank of Thailand, in 2021, Singapore and Thailand linked their real-time payment systems, PayNow and PromptPay, enabling customers of participating banks in Singapore and Thailand to transfer funds of up to $1,000 to or 25,000 baht daily across the two countries using just a mobile number. The Sino-forming of the world has far-reaching strategic implications. China's influence in Southeast Asia is growing almost as fast as its trade profile. Indonesia has embraced China's vision of economic development driven by digital infrastructure and managed by Chinese technology providers. The Philippines elected Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos by an unprecedented two-thirds majority, partly on a platform of greater economic cooperation with China. Turkey is now an economic dependency of China, which has sustained its imports despite the collapse of the Turkish lira and rampant inflation in the country.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. God says that if you are grateful, He will certainly give you more. In another, he says, And if you are ungrateful, My chastisement is truly severe. Quran is full of divine traditions. I said this that from the beginning of the Quran to the end of the Quran, as you can see, the divine traditions are continuously being explained and repeated. They have been mentioned in different places in the Quran. Such has been the course of Allah, and that has indeed run before, and you shall not find a change in Allah's course. The Holy Quran, Surah 48, verse 23. There are four or five such cases where God says the divine traditions are immutable. This is because the divine laws are perfect laws. God is not family with anyone. To say that we are Muslims, we are Shia, and we are the Islamic Republic, so we can do whatever we want, is not right. We are no different from anyone else. If we put ourselves in the situation of those first kind of traditions, the results will be that. If we put ourselves in the situation of the second kind of traditions, the results will be this. This is definite.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the year 1981, in the face of all these events and all these severe attacks, we were able to stand on our own feet and frustrate the enemy. And we were able to do this today too. God, in the year 2022, is the same God he was in 1981. God is the same in different times of difficulty and at all times. And all the divine traditions remain in place. Let us try to put ourselves in the situation of the divine traditions for progress. God is the same in times of difficulty and at all times. Now, let's talk about the issues relating to the judiciary. Mr. Mohseni presented a good report. Let me mention some of these points that I wrote down. He told us in his report that this and that has been done. I would like to say this again. The judiciary is like the other executive branches. Because one of the fundamental pillars in the country is the judiciary. Not just in our own country, this is true everywhere. Your successes and failures are both doomed to the rulings of the divine traditions, and they affect the whole country.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.